one of our listeners, a really great woman that has played an essential role in editing the chapters of the various books that I've written, was listening to the show the other day, and we were talking about Paul having claimed to have been trained as a rabbi. Now, he never claims that he actually was a rabbi, but yet he makes the claim that in terms of schooling, in terms of the practice of the religion, that there was few, if any, that were as zealous or as exacting in the practice of rabbinic Judaism as he. And that he was taught by the most acclaimed of all rabbis at the time, Gamaliel. And so he was claiming is to be a rabbi. I mean, there's only rabbinic Judaism. You go to school to be in rabbinic Judaism, you're trained to be a rabbi. And he admits that he was a Pharisee. And so here it's likely that he is claiming to be a practitioner of rabbinic Judaism, where that's clear. And yet, in all likelihood, he was washed out of rabbi school. Somewhere along the line, it became obvious to the rabbis that Paul was vicious, that Paul was mean. And so this lady, Jackie's her name, first name, wrote me and says, you know, addressed this aspect of Paul. And it's in Habakkuk 2:6. It says, there are hard and perplexing questions that need to be asked of him, and double dealings to be known regarding him. So they should say, woe to the one who claims to be great, so as to increase his offspring, acting like a rabbi, when neither apply to him. For how long will they make pledges based upon his significance, becoming burdened by his testimony? And this is after naming Shaul by name, saying that Shaul, the given name of Paul, was the plague of death. So here it even draws attention that he would act like a rabbi, that he would make grandiose claims, and yet none of these things apply to him. And God's saying, you know, there are questions that need to be asked of him. Why aren't you asking these questions? And so Jackie writes, could it be that Shaul wanted to take Judaism down because he washed out of the rabbi program? Could it be that Paul, inspired by Satan, accused the Torah as the causation of his perversions, both allowing him and the demon possessing him to focus on the Greek and Roman cultures in creating the new religion of Christianity? She's right. I did not make those connections as we were reviewing Paul's claims yesterday and the end of last week of the practice of Judaism causing him to be murderous, when that was an absolute lie. But then he says, you know, I was the best of the rabbinic students, and I got my rabbinic training from the top of the rabbinical teachers. Well, he obviously flunked out of rabbinical school. And yet he made the claim to those who were ignorant that, oh, he was the best of all the students. And yet, held him accountable. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
I think she got it right. That's a nice connection.
Yeah, it is. Well, no, I actually did see that. I did see that where he said he claims to be a rabbi and he is not. Says so.
Correct. Yeah.
Says so.
Yeah.
And of course he ran around claiming to be the rabbi of rabbis, and then he bragged about Gamaliel being his teacher and nurturing him at his feet and all this.
Right.
And, you know, that's the very guy that Yahusha. He was the head of a bunch of rabbis. Yahusha called a bunch of snakes.
Right.
You know, that's some brag to be raised by a bunch of snakes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just astonishing when you put Yahusha's comments next to Paul's. And their perspective, their attitude, the things that they value, the things they disdain, everything is the opposite. And then for Christians to believe Paul's claim, his grandiose claim, that he not only speaks for Yahusha, but that he's the sole representative chosen by God back in the womb to speak for Yahusha, and that everybody else that would say anything about him is wrong and must be condemned, that he alone is the guy, when everything he says is the antithesis of what Yahusha said.
I've got some notes where I compare, you know, as an example, Yahusha saying, call no man father, you know, and he always pointed at the Yahweh, you know, because he's your father.
You have only one father.
And then Paul saying, follow me, I am your father, through the Yahusha Messiah. Here the Messiah himself says, don't even call me father, you know.
Right.
But old Paul, he's game.
Oh, yeah, man. There are 1,000 comparisons like that.
Oh, yeah. That's just such opposition. Or the one where in Hoshin, I talked about this. You know, he says, you put kings in place, you put princes in place. I didn't know them. I didn't do it. Then Paul claims every governmental institution in the world is there because Elohim put them there. Sure.
It's exactly the opposite of what God said. Now, the one that you and I focus on so often is that Yahusha is telling his disciples. He says, you know, there's going to be those that are going to come that claim that they have seen me in the wilderness. And they're going to be persuasive. In fact, they're going to be so persuasive, they're going to fool even those who are called out. And then but says, do not follow them. You know, they are deceivers. That is not true.
Or you're going to lose your place in the inner room. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Paul made the exact claim that Yahusha said that someone would make and fooled many of the chosen. And Yahusha says the person making that claim is a liar. Don't follow them.
Yeah. Well, that would make Yahusha a liar, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it?
One of the two. Either Yahusha's a liar, and if Yahusha's a liar, then Paul's a liar. And if Yahusha is telling us the truth, and he is, then Paul's a liar.
And, I mean, you know,
there is no way that Paul comes out of this unscathed. That's why I say that to be a Christian, you either have to be ignorant of what Yahusha said and what Paul said and what Yahweh said. You either have to be ignorant of it, or you have to be wholly and completely irrational. So if you're a Christian, you're either ignorant or you're irrational, because you cannot be an informed, rational Christian.
Well, here's one of my favorites. And now this is off P46, so it's the oldest on the planet from Paul.
Right.
You must look and become acquainted with and pay great attention how tall and great the letters I wrote to you with my own hand are.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know what he wrote in those letters with his own hand? That circumcision was evil, that it enslaves, that it has absolutely no effect. And
he wished those under the Torah would be castrated. I mean, am I making a mistake there? That's what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what he said with his own big letters, with his own hand. And
here's one of my favorites.
And by the way, what does Yahweh say about participating in Passover if you're a man and you're not circumcision?
Don't do it. You can't do it. Not even to bring anybody to a Passover.
Right. You know why Yahweh says you should not partake in the invitation of Passover if you're not circumcised? Why?
Yes. Well, because Passover is what brings a person to eternity.
Correct.
And once you've been brought into eternity, you have to be perfected.
Right.
And that's with matzah.
Right.
And then beyond that, you have to be adopted into the family through Bikurim.
Right. And Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim are all one event.
They're all one.
And if you're not circumcised, you cannot be part of the covenant. Circumcision is one of the five requirements of the covenant. So if you're not circumcised, you are not part of the covenant. If you're not part of the covenant, you cannot be invited into Yahweh's family. You cannot be adopted into his family which means you now become immortal, but eternally estranged,
separated
from God. And there is a place where souls are immortal and eternally separated from God. It's Sheol. It's where Satan is going to spend eternity. It's where all of the popes are going to spend eternity. It's where Paul is spending eternity. In fact, Sheol and Shaul is the same in Hebrew. And that's why Yahweh doesn't want you to do that. He's saying, you know, it's one thing for your soul to cease to exist at the end of your mortal life because you squandered it. But it's another thing entirely for you to become immortal and eternally estranged. And if you are not circumcised and you answer the invitation of Pesach, that's where you're going to go. So don't do that. And what did Yahweh say about those who are not circumcised entering heaven? He talks about this
Ezekiel. It just is not going to happen, period.
Yeah. In fact, he even went a little further. He said that the lie being promoted by Israelites, and Paul was a Jew, the lie being promoted by Jews that the uncircumcised are welcome into my home is among the most egregious deceptions ever perpetrated by humanity. That's what he tells us. So, as fact, in this prophecy that Jackie referenced about Paul claiming, making claims, and one of the claims is that he's a rabbi. In that statement, does Yahweh mention Paul's animosity to circumcision?
Yes, he did. He says going on about the lack of circumcision. Yeah, he literally says that.
So God's position on circumcision would be the antithesis of Paul's.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Paul, God is saying, if you're not circumcised as a male, you cannot enter heaven. If you're not circumcised as a male, you cannot be part of my family, which means you cannot be saved. So that's God's position on circumcision. And Paul's position is that he wants everyone who is circumcised castrated. And he says, if you're circumcised, then you can't be saved. They're the opposites. How can a man honestly claim to speak for God when he contradicts him on something this essential?
Well, it's insanity.
It's insanity, isn't it? So Paul wasn't the only one who was insane. So were all of those who read his words as if they were inspired by God in their Christian New Testament. Larry, it is so obvious that Paul contradicted Yahweh and Yahusha in every meaningful way, saying in essence the opposite of what God has told us. Why is it, how is it, that 2 to 3 billion people believe this man? Are they, do they not think? Do they not care? Does faith supplant a desire to be reasonable? Is their soul so meaningless to them that they'll go along with the lies? Or is it a case where they're comfortable in the lie? The lie makes them comfortable.
It's a combination of all of them, but I do think that it's got to do with going along with the crowd. It's intimidation. It's, you know, to stand up and tell people what you've been told out of a book named after a sun goddess,
right?
Biblia. Is half trash when they've had millions of people, or, you know, dozens of people that they respect and love and all this nonsense, that they shove this in their face and say this is the undeniable word of God.
Oh yeah, the inerrant word of God. When the Christian New Testament has a name that absolutely prohibits it from being from God, because the covenant has not been renewed, so there cannot be a New Testament. So you start there.
There was a word in Greek for good news, and the good news is that it turned out the Torah was true, because the living Torah came and fulfilled the Mikra he said he would fulfill. That was the good news. And of course they take the very, he was fulfilling the very heart of the Torah. And so, of course he's only fulfilled four of those. There's three yet to be fulfilled. And at the time that they are all fulfilled, what will happen is that the Torah will be written inside of those who are alive.
Now there's a reason that only four of the seven have been fulfilled.
Yes,
and the reason is that that without those four being fulfilled, the promises that Yahweh has made relative to
the benefits,
his covenant could not, the benefits could not be honored. You know, the four benefits of our participation in the covenant are derived from the first four of these mikrei: Pesach, eternal life; matzah, perfection; Bukkudim, adoption; and Shavuah, enrichment and empowerment. And so he had to fulfill the first four in the 4,000th year, the fourth millennia of human existence outside of the garden, because it brings us right back into fellowship with Yahweh. But there are three that are unfulfilled at this point because they are addressing other things. Teruah is addressing what we're doing right now. The world is coming to a screeching halt, and God wants as many people to know the truth as possible.
Too.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that. The world's coming to a screeching halt, and we're bringing this harm upon ourselves. So Teruah is about us sharing that news. A warning regarding that is also the good news that the Torah provides an introduction to Yahweh and the guidance that we need to participate in the covenant. The reconciliation of Yahweh's family is the most sought-after event in the prophetic writings. Yahweh was constantly telling us why he had to divorce Yisrael and Yehudah for them being unfaithful and chasing after false gods, their religious practices. The practice of Judaism, which Paul is saying was so wonderful here, is the very thing that Yahweh said caused him to divorce himself of them. But he says that he's going to reconcile that relationship, and the reconciliation of that relationship is going to occur on the day of
Kippur.
Reconciliation.
The day of reconciliations. Yeah. Of course, that's copyedited to afflictions in most religious material.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. Yom Kippurim is the day of reconciliations. Kippur means to reconcile. And Kippurim would be the plural of reconcile. So the day of reconciliation is when Yahweh is going to reconcile his relationship with the Christian church, right?
Not hardly.
with the Gentiles.
No, that would be
No. He's going to reconcile his relationship.
Jerusalem, by the way.
Not in the Vatican, not in Washington D.C. And it happens amongst Yisrael, which are the descendants of Jacob, and Yehudah, which is one of the descendants of Jacob. That's who he is going to reconcile his relationship with. That's going to occur in year 6000 Yah. That is 2033 on our Roman Catholic pagan calendars. That's when it's going to occur. And following that, we get a 1,000-year celebration of Sukkah, where all the earth returns to Eden. Welcome back to Encountering This. We have both Larry and Glenn has called back in. Glenn has a question on circumcision. Maybe, Larry, we can try to answer his question. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hi, again, Yad. I'm surprised I haven't asked this before, but I've always thought about it. Here in America, not so much in Europe, but here in America, there are millions of us males who were circumcised at birth as a matter of institutionalized medical standard operating procedure.
Correct.
Is there any sense in which that circumcision, you know, since it wasn't performed with, you know, as a deliberate act of compliance with God's covenant, is there any sense in which that circumcision is somehow inadequate and that some further, you know, adult consenting intentional statement of compliance with the covenant is required?
No. There are four other requirements to participate in the covenant besides circumcision. But no, Yahweh is really clear about the fact that he is not prescribing who does circumcision how the circumcision is done. He has asked parents to circumcise their sons on the eighth day. And
right.
That really is the totality of the explanation, that he's asked parents to circumcise their sons on the eighth day. He does not designate any ritual for it or any individual who is to be assigned the practice or anything that's supposed to be said or done. It's not a religious experience. Now, because it's the requirement is as parents, we circumcise our sons on the eighth day, the child is not consenting. This child is not making a declaration that they wish to be part of the covenant. So the same thing would be true if my parents were anti-Semitic. So I was circumcised also at birth. And so my parents weren't doing this to say, we're going to raise him to be part of the covenant. My father had and mother had no clue what the covenant was.
It was a hygienic thing, you know.
Correct. It was a hygienic thing. Right. And so, but since circumcision is circumcision, it does not say anything about who cuts and what environment it's cut, or how much is cut that meets the requirement. Now, as you know, there are spoken of circumcisions apart from the eighth day of parents to raise their children to be in the covenant. And Abraham, for example, at 100 was circumcised, and over 100, and so he saw to it that his all of the males and his company an extended group were circumcised. So there isn't and it says that anyone wishing by their own choice, desiring to participate in the covenant or in Pesach as a male, be circumcised. So there isn't even a constraint on when we have it done. There is the instruction for parents raising their children to be in the covenant. But beyond that, there is no constraint of when it's done, where it's done, how much is done. So, I think the answer
the
is
idea
absolutely.
Of sort of deliberate affirmation or something.
Yeah. Yeah, Larry, you were going to say?
Yeah, the eighth day is symbolic of eternity. That's
of
the
course, like the eighth day of Sukkot. Right.
Usually done on the second. I like the second or third day, while the baby's still in the maternity, the baby and mother's still in the maternity
ward. Right. Yeah. Yeah. When our sons were born, my wife and I were not part of the covenant. We were not Torah observant, and we had both of our sons circumcised. I can tell you that I am appreciative that my parents did it, and both of my sons are appreciative that we did it for their benefit. And even though our motivations were not consistent with the covenant, they still get the benefit. It does not matter. Yeah, in the ideal world, we would we as parents would circumcise our sons on the eighth day,
right,
as our commitment to raise them within the covenant.
Right. Right, but if that commitment is absent, then there's still nothing further required. I would almost draw an analogy between in Christianity where there's infant baptism and people who say that it's baptism is
right
for the age of reason, so it's like,
right,
that one didn't count, I was just wondering if there was any didn't count principle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, infant baptism was part of the Babylonian religion, and
right.
It's a holy pagan act. And adult baptism is sort of interesting in the sense that baptism, apart from the symbolic recognition that your the spiritual mother, the Ruach Kodesh, is adopting you, cleansing you, is bringing you into Yahweh's family. Apart from that recognition, it would be wholly counterproductive. It's not a requirement, but it is an outward demonstration of being cleansed by the set apart spirit and being brought into her company. People ask me, you know, should I be baptized? I said, no. It's way too much religious baggage associated with it. There's only one reference to Yosha baptizing. And even it is in passing, and there's no verification of it. There's no explanation of where, when, how, why. And so it clearly is not a requirement for salvation. It's I think it's basically a waste of time, other than, you know, the Yosha himself being recognized by John the Immerser in the Jordan, and the spirit of Yahweh in the form of the dove visibly coming down upon him at that time demonstrates the symbolic nature of the act, but it wasn't required for the spirit was already on him. It's just that that Yahweh did designate that as a means of visibly, tangibly showing what was transpiring.
Yeah, and then you have, of course, what leads to the question of John the Immerser, the baptizer, John the Baptist, saying, he shall baptize you with the Ruach Kodesh and with fire.
Right.
What exactly?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Him. John the Immerser saying, you know, what I'm doing here is getting people wet. And that's what I'm doing here. I'm just getting people wet. And what he's going to do is going to have spiritual rebirth. And our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit, provides a real miraculous rebirth spiritually from above into the covenant family. And John the Immerser was Yohanan the Immerser. Acknowledged that. And so he himself negated what he was doing. You know, he was the biggest in the world at that procedure, the most noteworthy in all of human history in that procedure, and yet he negated what he was doing and saying, yeah, it's pretty irrelevant compared to what he's bringing.
Right. About circumcision, I think it's kind of laughable that there are groups who protest male circumcision on the basis that it's inhumane, cruel, and painful. And it's like, how about looking at the female genital mutilation?
I know. The comparison is just so so absurd. It's you know, there are proven health benefits, sanitary benefits, and also particularly in Africa, where venereal disease is so high, so prevalent. Many of the heads of state in Africa for the last two decades have been on major circumcision campaigns because studies that show that there's a correlation between circumcision and the tendency of someone not to receive or pass on a venereal disease. So
I'm a nurse, and I won't even go there. There are special, when you're learning hygienic care and bathing and stuff, there actually this distinction is made between the proper way of dealing with the circumcised versus the uncircumcised male. And circumcision is much preferable.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting, I don't know if it was you or someone else, but someone sent me a number of articles about a year ago. I think it was someone else. It was James down there in Texas sent me these articles. And one of his family members, I think a brother, was in medical school. And they were teaching about cancers in men, particularly in the genital area in men. And in the lecture notes that he passed on to me, they said, we don't know why, but there's about a 80% reduction in cancer of the genitalia amongst men who are circumcised versus men who are not.
Well, it's not rocket science. It's similar to the idea, why do women get so many more urinary tract infections than men? Women have very short urethras, and we men have
Right.
14-inch right. urethras, right?
Yeah, enclosed plumbing versus exposed plumbing where, yeah. where you know that bacteria like a wet, moist environment to grow.
Yeah.
And so, there are health benefits of this.
Yeah, well, add to that the fact that, you know, the uncircumcised male, they're being held in when rather as opposed to being cleansed away. So anyway, I think I touched on that.
Yeah, I like the two. Yeah. Beyond the health benefits, I like the two symbolic benefits of associated with circumcision. One is that it's a cutting, and everything with Yahweh is about the covenant is karat cut, and so you either cut into the covenant family or you're cut out of the covenant. So the very idea of cutting is appealing to me. The second is that the cut is not on the fingertips or the toes. The cutting is on the part of the male genitalia that is responsible for creation of the new life of a family. And so when you have procreation being the aspect of the male genitalia that you're going to cut, and now you're dealing with your children, you're right back into the covenant. So it's so symbolic of the covenant. It was a beautiful design from a health point of view and from a symbolism point of view to make circumcision the sign of the covenant. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I think we've had a very positive and enlightening discussion of circumcision. For those of you who are Christian and therefore view Paul's words as inspired by God, it is really important that you recognize among the first things that Larry said when he joined the program that Paul, at the end of Galatians, took the pen away from the gentleman who was writing down his words and said, now I want you to pay attention to the really big letters that I am using to write to you personally by my own hand. And he went off and denounced circumcision. He not only denounced the Torah, but specifically attacked circumcision. Circumcision is the reason that Paul was brought into Jerusalem for the Jerusalem summit. That he was universally and without exception saying that to be circumcised was counterproductive. That in his new covenant, you don't have to be circumcised. You only had to be circumcised in the old covenant, but the old covenant enslaved and could not save, according to Paul. So Paul's message is the exact opposite of God's. So if you trust Paul, you're distrusting God. If you follow Paul's advice, you're ignoring God's advice. Since heaven is God's home, since the covenant is his family. Larry, what do you think the positives would be of ignoring God's advice regarding the covenant and instead believing Paul?
Well, I can think of no upside, none. None at all. Upside. None. A lot of downside. No upside.
So would it be merciful and compassionate for you and I, knowing that Paul lied about circumcision and everything else that he wrote, to pretend as if Paul's a fine guy and that the Christian New Testament is inspired by God and that you're just fine if you're a Christian? Would that be a merciful approach for us?
No, it wouldn't be. It'd be promoting a lie. Matter of fact, when you go back to Habakkuk, I want to point out something that's missed there in chapter one of that onslaught where he's explaining Paul. He says, I will bring rock to argue against him. Rock.
I know.
That was Shimon, Peter's name.
Shimon Kephesh. Who is called Peter, because that's the Greek word for rock. But his real name was Shimon. He was named Kephesh, which is the Aramaic name for rock. Shimon was called rock, and Yosha went out of his way a number of times telling first of all to nickname him that to fulfill the prophecy, but also to tell him, listen, this guy, he's going to come and he is going to absolutely tear you to pieces. He is going to be the thorn in your side. You really need to be careful about him, and went on and on to describe Paul. And Paul ended up, or Shimon Kefesh, Peter, ended up writing the letter, which says that Paul's letters are all use circular reasoning. They're damnable. They lead people astray. They're extraordinarily confusing and counterproductive. And so it was the rock that came up against him. You know, when you look at the description of the Torahless one that is known as the Antichrist to Christians.
Not like
if
Paul,
you look in
he hates women, man. For one thing, has no love for women.
Yeah.
Paul was
right.
Very negative on women. Very
right.
Negative.
Yeah.
You're subservient.
Yeah,
you
loves men. Paul loved Timothy. Is opposed to the covenant, opposed to the Torah. I mean, Paul is the living epitome of the Torahless one. I'm convinced that the demon that Paul acknowledges possessed him will be exactly the same demon that will possess the Torahless one of the tribulation. And that one of the reasons that Christians are going to be fooled by the one they consider to be the Antichrist, but who is the Torahless one, is that his statements, his attitude, his perspective, his religion is going to be identical to Pauline Christianity. He's going to easily fool them. I think that's to a large degree why Yahweh speaks so negatively of America during the tribulation. Because the majority of Americans are Christians, and so they're going to be particularly susceptible to the Torahless one, whom they will view as the Antichrist, because his rhetoric will be identical to Pauline Christianity. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Glenn. Look forward to being with you all at this time tomorrow. May y'all bless.